Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love. In Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of So Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Hi, and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. This is Aramaic Friday, November the 14th, 2014. Our call-in number is 646-200-4169. Press 1 and that puts you in queue to talk to us. And we would love to hear your comments and your questions because that makes this your show. So first, let's welcome Dr. Michael Rice. Hi.
Thank you, dear heart. And we appreciate everyone who chooses to join us every day that you choose to join us. And actually, when you say it's Aramaic Friday, you know, one day gets to be much the same as the other when you're on the road like this. And I didn't even realize that it was Friday. So I'm still thinking that it's Thursday here. So I guess it's Aramaic Friday. That's awesome. That means that we have Dale Allen Hoffman with us today. Is Dale there?
Dale, who's that? I've heard of that guy. Hi.
I've heard of that guy. I've heard he's got an awesome website, DaleAllenHoffman.com, where there's some fabulous materials, especially there's a new offering. I hope the special price is still on, where he's giving a thumbnail drive with every product that he's got on it. I haven't gotten one yet. I'm not sure why, but, you know, I guess that's just the way
it is. That's because I can never figure out where you are, so how could I get it to you? I'd have to sort of throw it into the air ahead of you so you could catch it on the way.
Anyway, welcome, sir. How do you be?
I feel great. I'm right on the border of Alabama and Georgia. I had a little rest area. I'm on my way back from Florida, some stuff in the Tampa Bay area, and then Panama City Beach, and then now back to Asheville. So doing good.
Awesome. Well, let's say hello to Dr. Tim. See if Dr. Tim's with us today.
I'm here.
Well, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, doing beautifully well. Had a lovely support group last night. And, you know, we talk about these groups, and, you know, we had 15 and we had 18. And, well, last night we had two people plus me, and it was probably one of the better support groups in a long time for the individual attention, and both people got to do two worksheets, and we watched the last hour of the Mayan calendar video, and so we're just bopping along and glad to be here.
Awesome. Well, it's cool that we get two reports a week now on the support group. That's pretty fabulous. Since you've got two support groups going.
Yeah, I think it's somebody in my business group the other day said, it was yesterday morning, he said, so how is it that you found a way to do something that you actually love doing? I said, I don't know. Right. I'm just, you know, blessed.
Turn them on to the purpose worksheet.
Oh, I have.
That's the key to that one for sure, that purpose exercise and really tapping into who we are. Is such a blessing. You know, I look back to, and Dale, maybe you can share where you stand on this, but I look back to the days when I was in the business world. I had three businesses. I had about 60 employees. I had a Mark III on one side of my driveway, and I had an Eldorado on the other. I was single. I had a penthouse apartment in one major city and homes in two other cities and businesses in two countries. And I thought that's what life was about. And I worked my buns off. And people would look and say, wow, look what you've got. And I look back now and went, man, how poverty-stricken I was back then. I had stuff. You know, it's interesting. Carrie Ellis, when she was in Peru, came across some scrolls that she shared a little bit about on the show. Maybe at some point she'll share a little more about it. And these are ancient Spanish scrolls. And in the scrolls, they talk about this culture of gold that, you know, in essence, will destroy the planet for gold, and how we've come to value our stuff. And, you know, as you said with Ian Lundgold's video on the condor flies to the eagle, that when we hook into that calendar that's about the day you get paid, and when your bills are due, and you get up in the morning and, you know, what do I have to do today, rather than a calendar that supports you in being, that your life becomes about stuff instead of being, and or at least a balance in that arena. So it's pretty awesome when we can tap into who we really are as human beings. And then, you know, you've heard me use the example before of if I take an eye cell and I put it up on the lectern, is there anything I can give that eye cell to make it happy? You know, I think we can safely assume that an eye cell is happy and fulfilled when it knows itself as part of what it is. It's connected to an eye and it's seeing. But if it's sitting up there on the lectern, is there enough stuff we can give it? Enough money, enough power, enough gold, enough good investments, a big enough car, a big enough house, or, you know, enough sex, enough political power? Is there anything we can give it to make it happy? And people who are not in alignment with who they are seeking to make up for a non-being life. And there's no way to make up for that except to return to being. And I was just reviewing an evaluation for a young woman in her teens who has gotten caught in the drug culture, product of a broken home, and caught in the drug culture, smoking pot, doing ecstasy, and who knows what else. And I look at her evaluation scores, and here's a young woman that, and out of 10 areas in her life, 8 of them are in major crisis. And it's just like, how hopeless, seeming at least, it is for these kids who just have been taught nothing about how they work, have been supported zero in who they are, and live in such trauma that they're running off to drugs in order to anesthetize. It's just amazing. And to have the opportunity to create some support for a shift in that arena is just fabulous to have in somebody's life.
So, Michael, did we talk about this the last time on in the second hour of Ian's lecture, how it sounded so much like your work, where he was talking about if you're trying to use your mind, which only processes 24 thoughts a second, to keep up with consciousness and creation, which can process billions per second, you're always going to feel stressed. And if you're in that long enough, you're going to start to feel the fight or flight. And if you're in that long enough, you'll go unconscious. And then he says, the unconsciousness is the mother of all addictions and the father of all suicides. Did we talk about that already?
I think we mentioned some of that, yes. Yes, but it's a good recap because it's true.
Well, and so my to my ear, that sounds very much like several of your different lectures about this. And the point, the kind of summary piece that his three-hour lecture is leading to is that consciousness is, in our culture, because of our calendar and because of our emphasis on material things, consciousness is only oriented by time and place. But in the ancient culture, and the Mayans were just one of them, but the ancient cultures had a couple other aids. And so they had two other calendars they used, and one of them combined two factors. So you had time and you had place, but you also had one of 13 personal intentions that you chose to come into this world for. And then you also had 20 aspects of the divine plan that were, one of those 20 aspects would be active each day, and one of those 13 personal intents would be active each day. And so they had these two other aspects to help focus their consciousness and their awareness in life every day, and that's the whole point of his three-hour lecture. It's just really a help to become more conscious about your purpose and have that focus. So I just wanted to throw that in while you were talking about that.
Yeah, it fits perfectly. And, you know, in the context of this work, the word consciousness is not a word I use very often, but it would be the equivalent of being, the being that we are, the consciousness that we are. And that when we function out of being, our orientation is pressing and experiencing our purpose and who we are in the world today, and as opposed to gathering stuff to make up for a non-being life, you know, the whole game changes as you do that. And, you know, it's been probably 3 or 4 years since I've watched that video, since we originally started talking about it on the show. And so I should probably dig it out and go back and give it a listen again, because it's been a while. And maybe we can bring more of that conversation into the show. How does that fit for you, Dale? That conversation,
you know,
in the context of all the ancient areas that you've looked and studied, and of course, in particular, the Aramaic, being Aramaic Friday.
It brings up so much. Every time you and Tim were saying, it's like whenever you're sort of your focus, or you would sort of change the nuance of the subject, I would have a different thought, and I was like, wow, you know, and like then it was a different thought and a different thought. Because there's just so much there. There's so many depths and layers of richness in it. And, you know, the thing that really triggered, especially for me, was that difference between the sort of the life that I used to live. And you talk about, you know, the cars, the businesses, multiple countries, et cetera. And I think of that sort of life that I used to live and how I don't really think that I was really living. And if I was really living, it was just such a small percentage of that, because what it really was, it was like Groundhog Day. I would go to the same job, you know, basically the same hours, work all night, which is such a blessed thing, which means I never saw my family, except on the days off when I was in a daze staring at the wall, because I was used to sleeping all day and awake at night. And it, like, there was no actual life there. It was the calendar became something that I felt crucified by. I felt like, you know, like those kind of moments when you look and you've got a 12-hour shift and it starts, you know, at 6 at night and you go till 6 in the morning and you look up the clock and you're like, God, you know, it's got to be, you know, I don't know, 8:30, and it's like 6:27 or something. And that whole, you know, the feeling of actually even being a victim to that and being so bound within time and space and things where I wasn't actually even open. All I was simply doing was just going through doing this rote, repetitive, over, like living the same day over. And I, like, in the middle of that, I'm thinking, well, for the longest time I did it, you know, day after day after day. And then I start thinking, hey, wait a second here. I'm not going anywhere. I'm not even sure if I'm going in a circle. It almost felt like I was just really, in a lot of ways, standing still or just turning around in circles without even really moving much of anywhere. And it was like in the middle of that, I just disengaged and was literally going and doing the regular job that I was doing, the just over broke. And I would be there, and I started paying attention to my breath, and I started bringing the forgiveness work into what I was doing on a day-to-day basis and removing the veils, number one, of the ways that I suffered in the workplace, you know, the ways that I'm in the middle like, oh, God, I thought this job was done, and this guy's yelling at me, and stress, stress, stress. And I started actually living it, not sort of something that I was putting to the side, like, okay, when I leave work, then I can start living that kind of stuff. Because right now I'm just doing my thing. But I applied it right where, you know what Teddy Roosevelt said, do what you can with what you have where you are. And in the midst of doing that, I'm thinking, wow, you know, I need to really start sharing this. You know, I got to, you know, let this out. And I start talking to other people about it. And that was right at the time when I hadn't seen you, Michael, in several years at that point. And all of a sudden you popped back up and sort of, you know, we're like, well, how's everything going? And it was like help sort of reminded me, you know, to recalibrate the system, so to speak. And then on the side of, you know, the regular job, the regular J-O-B, that obligation, that Groundhog Day, that repetitive over and over and overness, I started doing things on the side, one-on-one with people, little groups and things. And then it comes to that point where I remembered what I was here on in the first place for. There's a thing that Rumi, in Coleman Barks' translations of Rumi's poems, where he talks about it's like using this fine, precious sword to cut rotten meat. I forgot completely why I was here. And then what happened was, you know, things develop and all of a sudden we hear wind that the places, you know, the CD, DVD division of where I worked was going out of business and everybody was going to get laid off. And everybody except for me goes, oh, my God, oh, the end of the world. Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, this is my chance. So I started really lining up my ducks and I started scheduling events in the months after I knew that the thing was going to fall apart. And here it is, that old frame that no longer fit in my life, that shell cracked and fell away. And I saw so many people screaming, yelling. Some people quit on the spot saying it was beneath them to work for a company for another 6 weeks, you know, when they know that they're going to be canned after that. And it was like I just hit the ground running. And then it took a while to get from that, what's my puzzle piece in society, in the world, in the economy here in the U.S. It took a while, and it had quite a learning curve of going from what appeared to be give them this specific amount of hours and get back this specific amount of money, and it turned into like, you know, nothing, nothing clump, big clump, nothing, nothing, nothing clump. And you know what, though? The thing, the reason, like in the beginning, I think the reason the learning curve was so intense wasn't because I was doing all these different things, so much as I didn't even realize how hypnotized I was by this cultural economic puzzle that I somehow felt that I was a part of. And when I realized that that drug was no longer in my system, that drug of that fake, you know, mask of security, and there's no real security in it whatsoever, really, except in my head, when that drug was no longer coursing through my veins, which took a while, all of a sudden I realized, hey, wait a second, this clump mentality that I'm going through in a lot of ways was because that was the way I was living my life. I was depending on some kind of drug of this outside, you know, nutrition system coming from some sort of predetermined pattern that came from society. And it's like when that was no longer there and it's just me relying on what's actually there in my being and realizing that I'm here to express that rather than to somehow create some mask that lives up to someone else's ideologies and visions. The more I allowed myself to be open in that flow of being lived rather than living a life actually being lived, it started becoming so much more consistent, and it wasn't so much, and it's still, you know, clumpy in that way, but it's amazing how even just in the last few months, all of a sudden, more people are showing up to events and the crowds get bigger and, you know, the financial support is getting bigger and everything has, and all of that comes from, you know, it comes from forgiving the, whatever that goal it is I hold for that present moment that thinks that there's somehow a moment that's better than this one that I'm in right now. But when I was in that system of going through that Groundhog Day, I didn't want to be in that, and of course it wasn't until I forgave that from my system that I was able to, you know, transcend that or end the trance of that and move beyond it. And wow, I mean, what a way. I could obviously, you know, if I had to do something, you know, I just can't imagine going back to that anymore. I mean, I'm being lived through, and even being out on the road, which, you know, that can get tough with family at home, but this is what I'm here for, and it's just such, you know, it's just such an amazing way to live. I just can't, I have so much empathy for the people who may on some level feel locked within that system, and I'll offer them, you know, the key, which is themselves, to show up fully, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to take the key. So that is what it is.
Well, definitely people who, you know, if you buy the so-called scientific premise of our culture, we're an accidental chunk of protoplasm, not much different than a cow or a pig or, you know, a carrot, that just happened to evolve in the world. And so what? You know, do whatever you do because you're such an accident, it doesn't matter anyway, when the truth is we are part of an eternal bloodline, given our family genetics, a gift to take care of. I love how name's not coming to mind. Salk, Jonas Salk, the inventor of the Salk vaccine, says one of the greatest gifts you can give to your family is to be a good ancestor. And yet that's been so discounted, and, you know, we've been trained from our so-called scientific gods to look down on those cultures who have ancestor worship and, you know, really have any concern about their ancestors, or for that matter, their descendants, because it's all just an accident. But when we recognize that we have a heritage and that we are eternal beings, and when you start tapping into what your purpose is, all of a sudden purpose gives direction to life. And there are many forces out there that want to control everyone else's creative force. And so this brainwash that we have no purpose, that, you know, we are not the offspring of love, we're just an accident, leaves us kind of floundering with, well, I guess whatever you choose to do, you choose to do, so what? As opposed to there's meaning and there's purpose behind it all. And we do have an exercise, if anyone wants to tap into that, you can go to whyagain.org, our website, click on the bullseye, and just look down the list to the purpose exercise. And there's a three-part exercise. It's pretty self-explanatory. But if you choose to do it and you want to get some support with it, you're certainly welcome to call into the show with questions. But basically what that worksheet does is it helps people to bypass the brainwash of the culture and start to tap in by looking at their own faculties, tap into who they are, and what the real purpose is. And when we start to do that, and, you know, what I hear you describing, Dale, is living life without purpose and living life on purpose. And the difference is day and night in the energy that flows through us and in the satisfaction that comes from living that way.
It's amazing how that works, isn't it? I was just going to say that I was just going to say just briefly that it's like the repetitive pattern of doing the same thing over and over and over and over again. You would think that you'd be able to do it so well that you would have a flood of energy, but it was exactly the opposite, actually. It was like Ernest Holmes would said, you know, it's not what is it? He said it's actually low aim that is, you know, that is the sin. It's like thinking that you can't be more, you know, and he always, you know, Ernest Holmes's work was always focused on being more and being more. And when I was, you know, down on that, you know, low level of just that repetitive thing that I did over and over and over again, I didn't have enough energy barely to even get to work. And I would just be there on that, and I'd sail through that, coast back home, and, you know, take that energy back home with me. But wow, what a difference now.
Well, when you recognize that we are an energy system, energy systems bring through more energy, not by efforting, which is what the world teaches us to do, but bring through more energy by aligning, the primary orientation point, the primary alignment point is your purpose. Without that, what have you got? You know, going back to the idea of the Lord's Prayer in Aramaic, and that it is how to orient yourself to be the active space of love in the world. And as we orient ourselves correctly, then that's when the energy flows. and those who function without purpose, pretty tough to do. And so, you know, a case of beer, a visit to the Coliseum, and of course the Coliseum is brought in every day to, you know, many people's television sets. The, you know, the gridiron is just another substitute for the Coliseum. Instead of living a true, actual life where we actually have the experience of life, so many people sit back and, you know, they're looking at life on the tube, at somebody else's life, and accepting that as a substitute, going and doing their J-O-B just over broke, and paying for somebody else's weapons to kill and steal from other people. I mean, the whole thing is just so bizarre, and it's certainly time for a wake-up to start to experience and realize who we are. And, you know, wherever, you know, a lot of times people talk about those terrible people who want to get us and you know, create war, all the while participating in the war game. If we could but get a core number of people who actually functioned out of their purpose, no one would have any interest of going and taking someone else's property, because there'd be so much abundance, there'd be so much aliveness, that there wouldn't even be a thought of such a ridiculous thing. And, you know, the solution of, well, let's just buy a bigger war machine and fight more battles, and that becomes just one more drug, one more way to anesthetize one against living a non-being life. And the orientation of being, or as Ian calls it, consciousness, that we are the active presence of love and functioning out of alignment with that, is to me such a key piece in the puzzle. And then, of course, the Aramaic forgiveness piece comes in of removing, forgiving what's inside of us that keeps us off course, that keeps us off track, the hostility and fear, the rage, the grief, the guilt, the pain, that keeps us off track from, and the survival, you know, just the desire for stuff and money that keeps us off track from experiencing and expressing who we are. It's definitely time for a wake up. And, you know, as I said, I look at the evaluation scores of this young person, and 8 out of 10 areas in major crisis. I mean, that's, what a load. I just lament for the young people in this culture who have been taught the scientific religion of evolution, and, you know, that this accidental creation process, or this accidental evolution process, that, well, you just happen to you know, crawl out of the slime, so what? It's just like, what a poverty-stricken mentality comes from that whole perspective on life. It's definitely time for wake up on the planet.
It's also interesting to put that beside that sort of very westernized Christian idea that there's some all-powerful man. Of course, it has to be a man. It's not allowed to be a woman. Of course, it's a human, but it's a big human, I guess, with a big white beard that somehow calls all the shots for us. And if we piss off that big human that's up in the cloud, somehow we're going to burn in some kind of a hell that didn't even exist till about 1,000 years ago. If we could just pull ourselves, and that's what, you know, when I was so deep in that Groundhog Day, you know, type of mentality, I was in the, it's funny, I mean, there's this little piece in the movie Elf, actually, with Will Ferrell, which is a hilarious movie. Then he gets, you know, sent down to the mailroom at the Empire State Building, where his father, James Caan, works, you know, at the Empire State Building. They send him down to the mailroom to work, and he, you know, looks at this guy next to him, and he's like, you know, ooh, look at that, syrup and coffee. And the guy's drinking, he's got, you know, whiskey that he's putting on coffee, in coffee. And then Will takes it, thinking it's, you know, maple syrup, drinks it, and he gets drunk. And they're sitting there, laying back in this mail bin, laughing. And this, you know, he's like, well, what brought you here? And the guy's like, work release. And he's like, well, you know, what are you doing with your life? And he's like, well, you know, I feel like I'm not doing anything. I'm 27. I'm you know, I got to get with the flow. And he's like, no, I got to get out of the flow, you know. And it's like, when I was in what I thought was that flow, that cultural, you know, it's a drug. I think I did have some sense of an idea, though. The drug was strong enough with that false security that I turned away from that sense that there's got to be more than this. And then what started happening was, even after all the time at Heartland and working with the forgiveness work, there was a period where I just kind of got lax. And what happened was it almost became like this cross for me where I knew that I could remove these suffering roots from my life, but it became this sort of like comfortable hell, comfortable suffering security thing. And I just kind of laid down, you know, on the nail, so to speak. There's a story that Les Brown says how, who was actually my original inspiration to become a speaker back when I was a teenager, Les Brown, and I told him that in Canada last year, which was a great moment. But he used to tell this story how there's a man walking down the street and there's a dog laying on a nail up on a porch on a house. He's just laying on the porch and the dog's moaning. And the guy says to the dog's owner, he's like, well, why is this dog moaning? Sounds like he's in pain. He's like, well, he's laying on a nail. He's like, well, then why don't he get up? He's like, well, it don't hurt bad enough yet for him to get off. And that was the way I was living. And I mean, I was so literally anesthetized by that sort of false security that I was able to just go along and go through this humdrum that looked like a flow that had nothing to do with the flow. And what happened, you know, I started thinking about things like the bugs and buzzards on the yard, you know, that Michael always talks about, how it's like when the energy system gets down to that point where it's no longer in that open flow with the divine, or whatever you want to call that, when it's not in the being state and it starts living from that mask. That's when it starts to atrophy, and that's when the system starts breaking down. And of course, all the bugs and buzzards come in. And then, of course, we're fed some other drug, be it narcotic or, you know, huge mega pharmacy company drug, to keep us just far enough above the line so that we can continue to feed that other drug of the culture, of the society, of the economy. And as I'm out doing, you know, living the life that I live, I have such an empathy for people that are in that. And yet over the years, I've really learned to just to be and stay in the openness and the flow of my own being, my light, the light that comes through me, as opposed to, you know, in the beginning when I was out doing this, I would feel, you know, have feelings of guilt and shame come up, like, oh my God, you know, all my friends, they're doing this, you know, they're still living that life. And I was, you know, finding things in me that were being hooked, and I started removing those. And now I can be in the presence of that and know that, you know, I can put it out and say, you know, I do, I can help you and show you a way through this. And they're like, yeah, okay, you know, sure. And I can do that and stay in my light, stay in that flow, and at the same time, always be within that forgiveness process of, you know, constantly calibrating and recalibrating and removing whatever it is in me that somehow feels guilt for those that are locked in that, and removing that, because all that does, of course, is bring my system back down again. It feeds into the same drug I was feeding into before. So what a learning process that's been in, you know, literally living my life mid-step and being lived. Mid-step meaning that I lift my foot to take the step, and I don't really know where it's going to land. And literally, focus isn't even on where it's going to land. My focus is that I'm taking that step consciously. And as soon as that's really shifted in the last year, especially the last few months for me, to the point where the entire world shifted around me, which, of course, was in my head. Everything shifted, and being in that flow, it's just such an awesome, amazing, indescribable in so many ways flow, infinite flow, that I never could have gotten to if I was, you know, just plugged into the drug of the culture. Wow. So there's my take.
Definitely time to stop using. Dr. Sim, your thoughts?
Really? Really, you want me to follow that?
There is no following. You're in that flow too, so.
Yeah, I don't have any words other than to say amen.
Amen, brother.
Amen, and let's wake up.
So we have a caller.
Let's check and see if I was just going to ask that question, sweetie.
It's area code 901. You're on the air. Who do we have?
Good morning. Anyway, this is Dean Memphis. Yeah. And can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay. I have a question for Dale Allen Hoffman on the worksheet. And I'm specifically was having some questions with 5B, which at the end says, help me open a direct conscious relationship with and gently remove the dissociated and projected parts of my CBM, carbon-based mind. I went down to the bottom to look at the definition of disassociation, and it says denial creates a hidden, separated, unchangeable, while denied, part of the mind referred to as the unconscious, the heart, or the desert. And I was a little confused when I first was working on this particular thing and say, well, why do I want to remove that part of the heart part of the mind? So I'd like to have some Aramaic input, perhaps, on the unconscious, the heart, or the desert. I understand how the unconscious and the desert kind of go together, but the heart was a question in my mind. So if I could get some input on that, that would be helpful.
Sure. The word for heart is liba. What liba in Aramaic, you know, just linguistically means it's the place where thought and feeling merge, where thought and feeling, which are, you know, single at their qualities of a singular continuum, the heart is at the center. You could also call it the seed. Heart, you know, I think because we sort of have this Western cultural idea of like roses and sunshine and like Halloween candy, not quite Valentine's candy, you know. What that's really saying is what's the heart of the matter? You know, what's the seed? What's the seed at the center that's actually creating this? And what's interesting in Aramaic is that, you know, another word, first of all, midbar, midbara, the word translated as desert, what that means is a raw, vulnerable, unprotected state. It goes right in line with the word ape, which is the word translated as hypocrite in the King James Bible. Ape literally means mask or sake, as in like an illusion of safety. It means persona, which means mask. And the mask was that mask that we would, that in the first century, you know, his listeners would have understood ape, knowing that was mask, because an actor would wear that mask, the ape, in a play, and they would put that on. Now, what, you know, what's obviously, you know, that's said there on that line in the sheet is saying that when your heart, when your mask becomes your heart, you must remove that. You must remove this heart. Now, that's the thing we've got to get, you know, it's right, it's exactly, you know, correct there on the sheet in that another way you could say that is the seed. What's the seed that creates, you know, what is it, the Keys of Enoch would call it the prototype. What's the prototype? What's that original heart of the matter? And the thing is, when our mask or that overlay, the bushel basket, becomes our heart, we have to remove that heart to allow the heart, the one heart, which is that infinite flow that we're speaking of, to live through you. And it's interesting because liba in Aramaic, it really was one, and Michael says it, it's one of those words that was virtually untranslatable in all these different linguistic translations over the last 1800 years, because they're like heart. So everybody thinks of heart just as like the human heart. But, you know, you could also say seed. You could say the source, you know, the source of thinking and feeling. There's so many ways to translate it. So it's not so much saying, you know, remove my, the heart, obviously, I think you know that, the beats in my chest, or that somehow I'm removing the love, but rather I'm removing what's at the heart of it, what's at its center. And when the mask or the non-being mind becomes your heart, then you are no longer alive, now you're dead. And that's what that line is, I think, beautifully saying. So I hope that's, you know, what you were asking.
Perfect. That is perfect.
I would add to that, before we move forward for just a second, Brenda, I would add to that, you know, when Yeshua says, you must forgive from your heart the wrongs of your brother. When we go into this state of denial, And there are two different things involved here. We dissociate. I know she used the word disassociate, but it's dissociate. That is, we hide something from ourselves, and we create this artificial place in us where we are unconscious. And then when a brother comes along and triggers that part of our heart, our unconscious, and, you know, what you shared in the show yesterday, when all that stuff came up in you or for you that was so intense, that would be the content of your heart or your dissociated mind triggered into activity by the goals you held in that circumstance. And if I take that content and I make a picture of my object of attention out of it, him, he's the problem, I rage at him, I've put my rage into my brain's image of my brother, and I think they're responsible for what's going on inside of me because I've dissociated from what's going on inside of me. So the idea there, when I put that together, is that I want to be able to come back into direct relationship with this part of me that makes pictures of other people the problem in my life, and come into relationship with what I've hidden from myself, what I've put into this artificial unconscious state, and as I come into conscious relationship with it, I'm removing that. My take is that it is totally and completely artificial for a human being to have an unconscious mind or anything that resembles it. I believe we should be able to be in touch with everything and anything that's in us at any time. But the minute I go into denial, the minute I start to talk about somebody else as the cause of what's happening inside of me, then I dissociate from, I hide, I create this artificial unconscious condition. And then I make pictures of other people out of it when it's triggered into activity. So then I want to forgive, remove from my heart, my unconscious, that part of me that I need to come back into conscious relationship with and let go of, remove. Does that make sense? Is that telling us what Bill's saying?
So then does the, when you remove the disassociated part and come back into alignment? I'm sorry?
There are two different things here. There's a distinction between those two words. There's the dissociated mind that is a product of denial, and then there's disassociation. Disassociation is when I cut myself off totally from anything going on within me. You know, I'm floating off in space somewhere. I'm looking at myself from the other side of the room. That's disassociation. When I deny and hide something from myself, I dissociate from it. And that's what we're looking to recapture, is that dissociated content, and remove that dissociated content, come back into relationship with it.
Okay, now when I dissociate and bring that, or I bring that content, or get rid of that content, or release that content, forgive that content, then the heart, the Aramaic concept of the heart as the seed, is still the seed, but it's a seed for a different purpose?
But I'm conscious then. It's the part of me, I'm conscious, you know, when I look at, you know, that issue that you spoke of about yesterday was totally unconscious, and notice as you've done your work around it, you've come into conscious relationship with it. So it's no longer hidden content.
You know, I think a great sort of aspect is, you know, each and every one of us is a fruit tree bearing fruit whose seeds are contained within itself. You know, the heart is within, you know. And when we're giving that light of the true heart of, you know, the heart of truth with capital T, and we have that, you know, we can actually live a life where we put bushel baskets over top of that heart. And although that true heart is still there, when there's bushel baskets over top of it, those become the heart. And that would be mammon. You know, you can't serve both God or wholeness and, you know, truth with a capital T and mammon as in bushel baskets, layers, veils, and masks simultaneously, or what Michael's, you know, the unconscious. And the difference is that, yeah, when you remove that unconscious content that has been your, you know, your false heart, you know, that sort of unreal seed at the center that's been creating your life, when you remove that, now you're actually conscious. And in that consciousness, you know, in that true aspect of being, you're no longer sort of going through that sort of the drug of the mask that is simply some sort of subconscious thing that we're not even, you know, we're just kind of going through almost like droids or robots or something. So, yeah, the heart, the seed and the heart, I mean, that's really, that's exactly what the worksheet is. It's removing that false seed or the false heart that lays over the true heart. So.
Okay. Thank you.
We can tie it back into the conversation with Dr. Tim earlier, too, where he talked about this calendar, the Mayan calendar, that taps people into their purpose. The person who's not in touch with their purpose functions out of the unconscious, functions unconsciously. If they have no idea of their purpose, they go, oh, well, my job today is to go out and get more money so I can get more stuff. If I uncover what's in my heart, and the idea of that calendar to me would be that I have this calendar that points me in the direction of, ah, this is what the energy of the universe is supporting you in expressing as your purpose today. And my purpose, I might sit with the calendar and get the guidance that comes out of the unconscious level into conscious awareness of, oh, what I need to do today, the energy of the universe is supporting me ideally today to clean up my relationship with Dad. That I tap into the energies that are coming in today, and instead of ignoring that, I let that calendar support me in bringing this forward to awareness. And, oh, so this is my guidance, is I'm going to focus some of my energy today on dealing with relationship with Dad, or, you know, whatever happens to be the purpose for the day, rather than floundering unconsciously because I don't have the support of a system such as that Mayan calendar, which every day, my understanding is in the Mayan culture, every day people would get up and they'd look at this one particular calendar and, oh, this is what my life is about today. This is the direction I'm going. And it was used to help people to be conscious of what energies were moving around them and what support they had in their world.
I'd like to have that calendar.
Well, you can actually go online. There's actually a daily email. I don't have it, but I'm sure if you Google it, and they'll send you an assessment, you know, the daily input from that calendar. So if you Google that, I'm sure you'll find it.
All right. Good. You have a second error.
Probably like the one Mayan Magics. You know, the place where that the condor flies to the eagle is on Mayan Magics, magix.com. And probably there's a link to their daily calendar email on that site.
Okay, thank you. I have a second Aramaic-connected question if there's time.
Go for it. We've got 10 minutes.
Okay. When Dr. Tim, I think, was talking about, or whoever was talking about the purpose process, doing the worksheets and such on the purpose process.
Right.
When I did this at a seminar and I did the process and we were to find out what our life's purpose was, I just had the intuitive thought to write the entire conference with my left hand. Now, I'm ambidextrous, so I can write legibly with my left hand. But it was just really amazing came out of that. So ever since then, when I get stuck in something, I start writing a worksheet or something, I'll start writing with my left hand. And so I'd like some input from Dale Allen about what the Aramaic tradition or such has to do with, you know, switching hands and triggering the different sides of the brain.
I'd love to say there's a lot there, but there's actually really not all that much in the Semitic cultures. especially not that's really related like with the Yeshua teachings. There's some Gnostic idioms that are threaded within, things like the right hand of the master and all these different idioms. And people have different theories in a lot of cases about what those are, but we really don't know completely. I will say, though, that one thing that's very puzzling to me was that a lot of the Greek and Roman cultures, if you actually wrote, they really forced people in the time of Yeshua, before that and even after, really forced people to stay with the right hand. And one of the main reasons for that was because of the way things were, it was an old tradition that came from when things were written basically on stone. And a lot of people say, why do the Semitic languages go from right to left rather than left to right? And people try to say, oh, it was because it was a deeper, you know, absorption, you know, in the mind. That's all bunk. The actual reality was that it goes from right to left because they were mostly stonemasons before they had papyrus and parchments and vellum and things like that. And they would actually, if you were left-handed, then if you were working with stone, your hand would cover the character that you were working on and you wouldn't be able to see it. So they made it from right to left, which is pre-Hebrew, pre-Aramaic. It goes back to Akkadian, which is probably the oldest language that we're aware of. And the root sounds that are in Hebrew and Aramaic, you know, most of those actually come from Akkadian, a really old Semitic language, which could be from the mother language. But what was bizarre for me in a lot of researching Roman and Greek cultures was that if you actually... if a kid started favoring the left hand, they would first warn them and say, and this is something that's pretty easy to find if you research it, they would basically warn them, you know, you need to move to your right hand. If that didn't happen, they would begin hitting with various things like sticks, et cetera, the left hand. Eventually, they would, and this is only in a few cases that I've seen, they would actually crush the left hand so that you couldn't use it anymore. And the most extreme case in some of the things that I researched was they actually even cut some children's hands off. A bizarre, strange, barbaric culture. Now, in the Aramaic, in the Semitic cultures, they didn't really have that going on. That was more of a Greek and Roman peculiarity that's just unbelievable. And, of course, those are the people that are credited, you know, in a modern theological seminary with supposedly writing down the words of Jesus. So, yeah, that's a little puzzling for me, but
there's a lot that's puzzling about that whole game for sure.
Yeah.
I think that's all my questions for today.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate your contribution. We hope your day is blessed and all moves well in your world today.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Brenda. Blessings. Bye bye. And Amy, do we have anything happening in the chat room that would be good to be aware of, and or anybody with a hand up in the phone queue? Hello, Jeannie.
Hey. Apologies.
You challenged
me. Yeah, I know. Nobody has their hand up. We're down to 5 minutes, so we can take one more caller. If somebody would press one, then you're in line with no wait. And... Peace is holding down the chat room for a big part of the time, and I told him I appreciated that. And we were just kind of following your conversation. So there's no questions. Oh, a hand just went up. Area code 810, you're on the air.
Hi, everyone. It's Adam in Attica.
Hey there, young man. Good to hear your voice.
Likewise. Awesome show. Been really enjoying it.
Cool. So how can we support you today?
Well, I've just been thinking since the Mind Shifters Day, one of the things that has stuck with me since there very strongly is just how, you know, what's going to heal is just to keep breathing. And since then, I've been noticing how difficult it is to continue breathing when I'm trying to do some of the behaviors that don't really support my being. And also, there's something else to it, but I can't remember for some reason. Oh, yeah, you'd also told me.
Take
like,
a breath.
I have to be like... Yeah, Yeah, when I asked you, like, you know, if I, you know, if the stuff that I let go of during the breathing session, if, you know, if it was gone permanently, you also said that, you know, as long as, you know, if I don't repeat the behaviors that created it. And, you know, I've been feeling frustrated recently because I see some of this tendency to go into these behaviors that are creating these, you know, stopping breathing. And I have been practicing more consciousness with just trying to remind myself that's what will heal. So, but it's been kind of a struggle.
Yeah. And notice there's just a little twinge of dissociation there, denial. You know, I have frustration because of this. And my offering would be, you don't have frustration because of this, but when you say I have frustration because of this, then you, by putting the power to create the frustration outside of you, you dissociate from the cause of your frustration. My invitation would be just a slight shift of language, because words tell our mind how to build our realities. Ah, when I'm facing some of those patterns, I feel frustrated. And when I shift the language just that little bit, it can be a major key to how I access the part of me that holds and creates this frustration, and how I let loose of it, how I undo it and free myself from it. And, you know, when they go back to Yeshua and they ask him, well, how many worksheets, how many times are we going to have to forgive around this issue? You know, and in Aramaic, he says 77 times 70, you know. And so if I have, let's say, a level 8 issue, and I'm at a level 4 in vitality, I'm only going to be able to deal with or process through my level 1, 2, 3, and 4 energies around that issue. When I build to a 5, I'm going to get to see the next layer of it. When I build to a 6, I'm going to get to see the next layer of it. When I build to a 7, I'm going to get to see the next layer of it. And I'm not going to be finished with it until I get above a level 8 vitality. So we'll tend to visit those things repeatedly as we clean the patterns out. And then, of course, as you say, if I refuse to go back to the mind energy with which I created it and the habits and the behaviors with which I created it, then I get to delete those things permanently and move on to a different creative process. Good breath. All right.
Yeah, sounds good.
That spontaneous kind of breath is the one that heals.
Yeah, and I've also, other thing that's been kind of in my mind is when you recently said that that it's, you know, it's if we're willing and ready to let go, if there's a part of us that wants to reserve some of these patterns for certain situations with certain people, then we're not fully open to letting go, and so
exactly.
We sort of missed the opportunity.
Yeah, if I feel like this was viable and useful to me, then I'm not going to move through it. I'm not going to let it go. And I need to recognize that, you know, what I trust is my God, and the God I want to be in relationship is the one called love, not the one called frustration, hostility, or fear. In the meantime, we're down to just a few seconds, so I need to close the show out. Adam, we appreciate your call. And everyone, we certainly enjoy the presence of your energy with this work. If you're in Bristol, Tennessee, come join us Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night. And you can find the flyers on the website and bring a strange to the moment. Take the best of your eternal life. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie, who present the internal Aramaic process of forgiveness. Michael and Jeannie are here every Monday through Friday on Earth Angels Radio. For more on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. That's www.whyagain.com.